So we get this problem now of the quietude. Let's see how we're going to do this, or how it might be worked out in a pleasant way. Well, maybe the first thing to do is to simply sit down once a day and just relax. Just relax away from everything. Don't try to think of something nice. Don't try to think of something that isn't nice. Don't try to wiggle and twist and twitch until you get yourself all nervous again. Just sit down for a few moments and experience the peace and quietude of a universe that extends on and on through infinite durations, but is aware of the need of every living thing. Aware because within each living thing is that same power that moves the stars. After all, in this case, the cosmos and the human heart are very close relatives. In fact, one is simply the extension of the other. So in quietude and with a sense of peace, try to simply contemplate the reality of life as a kind of quiet security, a something that can always be reached, that whenever you are still and quiet and at peace with life, the inside will tell you which way to go. Therefore, you have a right to ask as the Indians ask, show me the way. But in that doing, do not try to tell this voice that you hope for the answer you demand. In other words, do not ask to be shown the way and then insist on going your own way as you always have. If you do, nothing happens. Except you will blame the infinite for failing you, when in reality you are the one who has misjudged the situation. Little by little you will find it possible to smooth out the common occurrences of life. You will find that it's no more difficult to live pleasantly with a family than it is to live unpleasantly with them. Now, if the rest of the family is so objectionable that you cannot live pleasantly with them, you always have the realization that in our modern life, changes can be made. But not until every possible means has been used to prove to you that you are not to blame for the situation. That you are not the one who irritates someone else, antagonizes them, or tries to dominate them, or is over extravagant in your relations with them. These things each person has to solve for himself. If at the end of a careful resolution and careful solution, you still find the problem unreasonable, then you always can take whatever steps you feel desirable. But these steps should also be made in peace, in love, in kindness, and in friendship. Nothing else works. Now, we know in the world of affairs that we are afraid of this and afraid of that. But most of the shadows that we fear most are phantoms, and these shadows are self-devouring. The negative shadow eats itself up finally and disappears. But always, a little special leadership is required to keep our own minds and hearts correct. We have to develop a certain amount of discretion also. We have to decide the best we can what is of first importance, what is the thing most necessary at any given moment. And we must try to do this with complete quietude. And we will find that this quiet way begins to affect decisions. Our decisions are more thoughtfully made. We do not have to rush into a situation. We can contemplate it, we can consider it, we can review it, and we can ask simply, is this the way that I should go? Gradually, these quiet ways of approaching problems can become habitual. The individual who once rushed to decisions and regretted them at leisure now has the possibility of being slower, benefiting from his own previous experiences, and gaining a new depth of insight and a new understanding of how to handle aggravations. By doing this, he is gradually developing vigil. He is gradually increasing the peace in himself. And the more peace there is in his own nature, the more certainly he can respond to the divine realities of his own divine part. It is all a matter of releasing the better, which we keep in prison by glorifying the worst. If we can get over this, if we can make sure that everything that comes out from our inner life is acceptable in the sight of the Lord, if we realize that we are gradually opening the door that leads into a mystical experience. Now, in the ancient times and also among primitive peoples, the mystical experience has been closely related to vigil. It usually occurs in one of three situations, either in vigil, which may be prayer or meditation. The second possible source is the tremendous power of labor. We may find our mystical experience in our work if our work is actually enlightened. The service of others can lead to an internal spiritual release of energy. The third possible source of the mystical experience is in the presence of the disabled or the infirm, the presence of a crisis, a critical situation in which, for a moment at least, we forget ourselves in the service of something else that is greater than ourselves. Like the man or woman who cannot swim, who jumps into the river to save the child who is drowning. Perhaps the child is saved, and the person who tried to save it is drowned. But this is, from the spiritual standpoint of things, a tremendously vital circumstance in an eternal life existence in which all incidents are comparatively temporary. So actually, the forgetting of self is important to the release of God through the human nature. Until we forget ourselves, we can never think of anything more important than ourselves. And the complete problem of vigil is to make this as quiet and peaceful as possible. An old Indian priest, medicine priest, sitting with his prayer plumes and his peace pipe, is asking divine guidance. He is admitting by the very asking that he is not adequate within by himself. Of himself he can do nothing. It is the Father in him who doeth the works. So quietly he asks for insight. He asks for understanding. He asks for wisdom. Or the young Indian going out into the forest, maybe in meditation or in vigil, asking for his totem, the creature that is to become his spiritual protection throughout life, as in much like the daemon of Socrates, a spirit guide, which was believed in by the Egyptians, by the Greeks, by the Hindus and the Chinese, that there is something that goes with us as a spiritual guide, and this something that goes with us is another name for our own soul, a soul which does the works of the Father if we permit it. The human soul is an ever-present protection against the limitations and misunderstandings of the human mind. And so in this way, the Indian priest goes out to ask to know. And one time, he has a sick person. And this sick person is very, very sick, and he asks the great spirit, the Manitou, to give him the key to healing for that person. And as he sits quietly in meditation, in a kind of a half-dreaming state, he sees lights all around him on the ground. Lights that he never sees if he looks for them. But lights when he is quiet look for him. And among the lights he sees a little flame. And it is around a little plant in the ground. And he knows instantly that the great ones have told him that this is the plant from which the healing medicine must be made for this particular sufferer. And by degrees he gains a pharmacology in this way. Here the Indian physician, who has never been to school, who has never actually been taught by any other Indian physician, who has never been given instructions by a previous priest of the tribe, goes out and becomes a doctor by simple vigil. The vigil that brings back to him the universal knowledge of mankind, a knowledge that has always existed and is available to every individual who can get over the hypnotic attraction of his own ignorance. This is a very important thing. And so the old Indian goes back and he makes a tea out of the old root that he found and gives it to the patient, and the patient is better. Then in another case, it is a matter of social problem. You must go out and ask what to do with the wayward child. And the spirits have to tell him what to do. And he has to do what the spirits tell him. And he will generally succeed in bringing the child back to the tribe as a useful citizen. All this is done in silence. It is done in a continuous condition of hopefulness, a condition of expectation that somewhere there is an answer to any question that the human being can ask. And that somewhere is somewhere in the depth of himself. So get rid of this surface is to begin to live the power within. In other words, it might be called the second coming. For the first coming was when it gave us life. The second coming is when it is released to give others life through us. And in vigil and those types of things, in fasting and in meditation, there are battles fought. Fought between self and self-interest. Battles fought as Christ fought them. When he told the evil spirit to get them behind him. And did all the various temptations and emerged victorious. Now, instruction as we get it mentally won't do this. But mystical instruction has always been very prevalent. Every religion has developed within itself mystical schools which were suitable to give inspiration and courage to the members. These schools simply have no creeds. They live within the boundaries of a major religion in itself. Therefore, the mystical sects of Buddhism exist within the structure of Buddhist philosophy. The mystic sects of Hinduism are part of the Vedas and the great sacred books, the Puranas, of the Hindu. The sacred books of Islam, the Quran, and the Masnavi, are the books which give the dervish his insight, and the Sufi his mystical experiences. And in Christianity, from the beginning, there have been mystical organizations. Organizations that sought always for the substance and were never deceived by the surfaces of things. There were always some to whom a literal acceptance of a doctrine was not enough. They could join the order, they could become one with it, they could tie to it, they could support it, and if necessary, they could even die to protect it, but they might never understand it. So it became very important to take literalisms and give them mystical interpretations. If people fail to do this, in the long run, they damage their own faith. For instance, in Christianity, we have now a major strife between Christianity as a religion and science and modernism and political atheism and all this type of thing. One of the great excuses or one of the great causes of this strife has been that they consider, or many consider, that the old theological doctrines are obsolete, that we can no longer fulfill them, we can no longer work with them, therefore we must get rid of them. Now, the thoughtful person looking for life knows this isn't true. He knows that the faith of the people of Christendom, this faith has guided, protected, and helped them for nearly 20 centuries. They know that millions of people have lived better lives and died with greater hope because of the faith of their fathers. We know there are many today who still hold exactly the literal teachings of 15 or 18 centuries ago. And we look upon these people as being a little too orthodox or a little too limited in their perspective. But now comes the eternal answer, the rise of mysticism. These people who are content with it as it is will stay that way. But those who have experienced the importance of religion are not going to give it up because it cannot be scientifically justified, or that it cannot be part of an atheistic society. They have something else. They realize through their own inner lives that the things that they have accepted literally also have metaphysical interpretations. They realize that it is not necessary to preserve the literalisms of things in order to become a member or stay a member of a religion. It is perfectly possible to be in good standing because inside we have found a better meaning, a larger interpretation, or a greater insight into a faith that others accept on the surface only. Consequently, it is perfectly possible for the individual to live with people who are very literal in their theology and not find conflict because they have sought deeper for a better meaning. And that is what we would commonly know as a religious reformation. Every generation has to adjust religion to its own level of acceptances. But behind all these different levels, there is the one fact that doesn't change, whether we understand it, believe it, or not. And all improvement and growth in religion is toward the realization of the one eternal fact. And one of the examples of that is very simple, namely that we have many great religions in the world today, but the motion in all of them is in one direction, towards the ultimate reunion of all beliefs in the presence of the one great spiritual power that they all honor. This type of thing goes back again to the inner life of the person and saves any further difficulties or estrangements due to theological differences. But vigil also is a great help physically with certain problems that arise. We are living in a very artificial society, a society that must change, that changed from something else to get what it is now, and must outgrow this and change to something else. Now, this contemporary social picture is short-lived, but it carries with it into defeat millions of human souls that cannot get out or cannot outgrow the particular concept that is prevalent today. Actually, we cannot work with this type of situation correctly unless we realize that all of these levels through which we pass and which are constantly unfolding around us, that all these levels are leading in one direction. They're leading to a mysterious reality that is the source of them all. All knowledge is one. There is no such a thing as a basic separation between biology and physics. Man has developed a separation, but they are all names for divisions and angles and aspects of the one tremendous reality which we are all seeking. Havelock Ellis pointed out in one of his books that when that one reality is found in meditation, there's no way of naming it. There's no way of actually describing it adequately. And that is its defense. Truth cannot be adequately described. It can only be known by experience. It must occur, some degree of it, some level of it. The ultimate probably is not attainable to anyone at this time. But what we consider as a small step forward can change the history of the world. So the realities of things cannot be captured in words, but they can be known in the heart. And when they are known in the heart, all of these mysterious truths sum up to one enormous silence, a silence of perfect and complete safety, a silence that tells us beyond all words that we are in an eternal pattern, fulfilling an eternal destiny, that we can delay ourselves by our mistakes, but we cannot prevent the ultimate fulfillment of the divine plan in ourselves as well as in the universe. This type of thing helps. And gradually, if we go into a kind of vigil, we can quietly begin to think in terms of God as the fulfillment of all these doubts. That God, not as a person somewhere else, but as the fulfillment and the spiritual eternity of ourselves. All of the bodies we build will fade and go, but the builder of bodies remains eternal. We will find that all the answers that we think we have will sometime prove inadequate. But as that time comes, a greater adequacy will come to ourselves. We may doubt whether we can face the problems of the future. We can, because we always have faced them, and because the power within ourselves is stronger than any condition that can arise in human relationships. Also, this power within, which Claude Bragdon refers to as the beautiful necessity, is in itself sublimity. It is something that takes away the power of doubt. It is something that is faith glorified and lifted up to a much higher level. This sublimity is something that moves upon us. Bamy describes it as simply a tremendous sense of fulfillment, an infinite sufficiency, something in which nothing is lacking, nothing that is needed can ever be absent, nothing that is right can ever fail. There's a tremendous eternal ocean of fact, of reality, of truth, of eternal validity. And this type of mystical experience has become, to mystics and also to a great many natural psychics, a tremendous source of strength. It has become obvious that the little world we live in is passing, and the little body we live in is passing, but the great facts of life never change. The realities will continue until everything in the archetype of creation is fulfilled. And all things are not punishments, but invitations to growth. The things that we call difficulties are invitations to solution. The weaknesses of our own character are the invitations to the development of internal strength. Everything that happens is beckoning us on, but because it may interfere with some little purpose of the moment, we try to resist it. We try to resist anything that interferes with the miseries of the moment. We have become so accustomed to suffering that we regard it as a badge of honor. It is not. It is simply a symbol of the inability of the eternal power to come through to us. This is one of the problems that we are finding now in so-called holistic medicine, particularly in the field of healing. Healing, we have had all kinds of explanations for it. We have known that long before there were doctors, there was disease, and long before the doctors, some of people got well. They got well because essentially the priesthood of healing in ancient times was part of religion. Christ said to the woman, "Thy faith has made thee whole." And there is something in each individual that can come to the rescue of sickness or debilities of one kind and another. Either they can be cured or they can be endured with dignity until the end of the particular pattern involved. But for the most part, they can be improved, and the ability to live with infirmities can be tremendously clarified and even glorified. It is all a matter of the individual's contact with the inner self. Vigil, therefore, in healing is the power of the individual to find peace of soul, peace of mind, and peace of heart. And when these forms of peace are achieved, the body comes under a messianic dispensation. We know that the little cells in the body, in a strange way, are religious. They're not religious because they have a theology, but they are like the beasts of the fields and the birds of the air. They are religious because they live a doctrine. They live a reality of truth. And they fulfill their own destiny with tremendous dignity and understanding, even though they seem so primitive. But these little parts of ourselves can be destroyed by the tyranny of our own ignorance. When these little parts of our bodies need love and thought and care and understanding and insight, and all we give them is a pill, something is missing. And that is why gradually Materia Medica is becoming involved in a hopeless dosage that does not result in any very permanent restoration of health. Actually, if the individual finds internal peace, it becomes like a revelation, like a spiritual dispensation to all the parts of the body, the organs, the nerves, the veins, all the parts of the body find a tremendous sense of recuperation if the personality is constructive and firm in its optimism and in its integrities. It then has also the courage and power to cooperate with the body in various ways, to assist it to restore its health and vitality. But the beginning is perhaps to realize in a quiet way, perhaps in a kind of vigil, that to this body in which we live, with its hundreds of millions of living things within it, we are God. We are God because we can control that body. We can be an evil demon if we pervert the rights and privileges of that body. We can save it or we can destroy it by an absolute autocracy of power. But autocracy of power is just as dangerous in ourselves as it is in society. What we need is a realization of a universal brotherhood with the atoms inside ourselves. We need to recognize our responsibility to those parts of life that are evolving within us and around us. And little by little, we can come to understand that it is possible for us to understand these atoms, even though it may not be possible for these atoms to understand us. We have the burden of responsibility. We are the guardians of the parts of ourselves, just as we are the guardians of our families, and just as humanity becomes the guardian of humanity itself. So in our meditations and in our vigils, we are helping all the parts, and the reward is that we are healthier, that we are happier. And vigil as a religious experience is a cause of health, of happiness, of growth, of gratitude, and a strengthener of love and friendship. All these things, if strengthened together, certainly will make better living for us than anything we know at the present time. We are still struggling in a competitive society, but the universe in which we live is cooperative and will never rest until we understand that. We are struggling with competition in our own bodies due to the wrong way of administering rulership over the parts of ourselves. We try to force growth. We try to overtax. We try to eliminate or avoid the recreation and peace that are essential to the maintenance of the body. We are not kind to the body, and then we blame the body for being cruel to us. So in the world of vigil, as we close off the outside, we enter into beauty. We enter into peace. We enter into all those wonders which science still seeks in vain. We enter into a great universe that is one life, infinitely manifesting, and a one life infinitely good in all matters, mindful of the sparrow's fall, mindful of the smallest and the greatest, because this mindfulness is in each of these creatures itself. There is one divine power distributed, disseminated throughout all existence. And that power is known to some as wisdom, and is known to some as God, and it is known to some as love. It is all these things. It is the one basic source from which all life flows, and it demands and requires that all life shall pay its homage. So with a little quietude and sort of thinking these kind of things through for a few minutes now and then, we can lay the foundations for a gradual growth of constructive realizations in ourselves. We can gradually come to live more beautifully because we have found true beauty to be internal and eternal. We can live to be more useful because we realize that the greatest use we can make of energy is to serve others, because the energy we are using or abusing is the life of God. All these things gradually temper our attitudes, and have tempered the attitudes of the mystics of all times. Behind these thoughts, we find the march of the sages, of the great ones of long ago, of the world teachers, of all those who have given of everything to serve the one God, manifesting through their own internal life. And as the Christian doctrine says, who has seen the Son, Christ, has seen the Father. And in the same way, we can say, those who have seen the body see the life in it. And if we make that life beautiful, then truly we see deity shining through all of the labors and works of the day. And it is better, it is easier, it is more kindly, and we also will have more opportunity to grow and to have pleasure. There is nothing about religion that should frustrate. It is not the duty of to religion to say, thou shalt not. It is rather the duty of religion to say, this thou shalt do. And maybe to make it just a little stronger, this thou shalt do regardless. You're going to find that truth is going to be served regardless. And if we become servants of truth, we then become useful members of a universal society. Little by little, thinking about these matters, meditating upon them, trying to live them and understand them, we'll put a foundation under book learning, under all the creeds and crafts that we know, and will help us to begin to appreciate that by power beyond ourselves, we are universal citizens of eternity. And regardless of all the differences arising, the same power of infinite love and truth is in everything. And each manifests according to its own life. And when man is able to manifest it to a great degree, he becomes a savior of life. And he becomes a being or person who will be honored forever by people who may not have any intentions of following his example. But that is irrelevant. We are going to follow these examples because we will never find peace until we are one with reality. But it isn't a quest beyond mountains or off to other planets or to the far distances of space. It is simply a quiet journey into the infinite universe of our own internal. And somewhere beyond the stars and galaxies, inside of ourselves, is that same great power that moves everything from the least to the greatest. And when we form a continuing partnership with that power to the best of our ability, we find that that ability increases, and that little by little, we attain to our universal citizenship in a creation that is forever good. That's it, folks.